Hello and welcome back to our digital class on soft condensed matter. Some time ago, in the second chapter of our curriculum, we have gotten a basic glimpse on and understanding of what soft matter actually is. It's a class of materials with three fundamental characteristics. Its building blocks are comparably large, in the colloidal domain of some tens to hundreds of nanometers up to micrometers. They are held together by comparably weak interaction energies in the order of magnitude of some few multiples up to tens of multiples of the thermal energy at room temperature. And in view of the motion of these building blocks, they take comparably long times to travel over distances which are as far as they are big. The latter delimits a characteristic timescale which we name the relaxation time, which for normal materials which are built out of atomic or molecular building blocks is on very short timescales like nanoseconds, whereas for soft matter, it is on more everyday life relevant timescales, from milliseconds over seconds up to minutes to hours in some cases. These three characteristic aspects make us understand why soft matter displays the fascinating properties that it does. It shows a rich variety of structures which are interconvertible and subject to multiple changes upon external stimulation. And second, and maybe most importantly, the comparably weak interaction energies plus the large sizes of the building blocks constitute a comparably low cohesive energy density, which is the reason why soft matter is soft matter. Its mechanical appearance is characterized by a comparably good ability to be deformed, as there is no so strong resistive forces between the building blocks of the material acting against that. And the comparably long relaxation times constitute materials that, on everyday life timescales, are neither true solids nor true liquids. They display the properties of both, being viscoelastic in their appearance. It is these properties, these mechanical properties, that have rendered soft matter very useful in a variety of applications, most of which designated to make our lives comfortable. But in addition to that, soft matter is also the very basis of many structures in living systems, because it fulfills a very important criterion for nature to create complex structures which are the basis of life, namely the ability to assemble, disassemble, and reassemble them in a reversible fashion, with the additional bonus of not having to work too heavily against entropy in this endeavor, because the large size of the building blocks comes along with a low number of them, thereby creating lower drops in entropy when forming complex ordered structures. In the following, we want to dive deeper into the first mentioned realm of properties, the mechanical properties of soft matter. For that purpose, we will now spend 4 lesson units on the topic of rheology, both from theoretical and experimental viewpoints. What is rheology? The term rheology, as many terms in science, derives from the Greek. It derives from the Greek word rheos, which means flow, and logos, which means understanding. As such, rheology is the study and understanding of flow of matter, and therefore a branch of physics and chemistry that deals with the deformation and flow of materials, both solids and liquids. These two last mentioned categories are two elementary cases which can be distinguished from each other. In view of a material's mechanics, it can either behave like an elastic solid, such as a rubber ball, or like a viscous fluid, like water or honey or syrup or so. Soft matter, as already mentioned, often displays characteristics of both, or something in between. We call those materials viscoelastic. Let's start with considering the elementary cases first. In the case of a purely elastic solid, we speak about a material that can be deformed reversibly, and the energy that is introduced during deformation can be fully gained back if we relieve the deforming load. Upon application of an external force, the material is immediately deformed to an extent proportional to the applied force, and a counteracting force builds up in the material. After relieving the external force, the material snaps back to its original shape, just like a rubber ball does when it bounces back from the ground after dropping it to it. A quantitative representation of the latter principle is given to us by one of the most elementary laws in physics, Hooke's law. It establishes a relation of proportionality between the two quantities just mentioned, between the extent of deformation and the force that is necessary for it, respectively the counteracting force that builds up in the material upon stretching it. To give a generalized form of this relation, we normalize both quantities, such that we express the force not as the force, but as force normalized by area. We name the quantity that results from this stress. The advantage of using stress rather than force is that stress is independent of the exact shape and cross-section of the material specimen that we regard. Second, we also normalize the extent of deformation by dividing the deformation extent by the original length in the respective direction of the material. The resulting normalized quantity is named strain. Both is visualized to you in figure 4.1a. The resulting relation is given to you in equations 4.1 and 4.2. This is Hooke's law in a normalized form. Stress is proportional to strain, with a constant of proportionality in between that is named the elastic modulus, also often named Young's modulus. A very idealized picture of such an elastic deformation is given by the analogy of an elastic spring, as shown to you in figure 4.1b. Usually, when putting a solid material under a uniaxial strain, this results not only in an extension in one direction, but also to an accompanying change of its lateral dimensions. To quantify this, we introduce the so-called Poisson ratio in equation 4.3, which quantifies this effect by relating the relative lateral contraction, expressed by the change of the specimen thickness relative to that before deformation, to the axial strain. The most simple type of materials are so-called incompressible objects, such as fluids. Those have a Poisson ratio of 0.5. This value commonly also applies to polymer samples, because a linear extension of a polymer sample is usually accompanied by a respective concurrent lateral contraction, meaning that it does not undergo any volume changes. What we gain in linear extension, we lose lateral to that. Another type of deformation of a material is when we do not stretch it uniaxially, but apply shear deformation to it, as shown you in figure 4.2. In this case, Hooke's law obtains a variant form, as given in equation 4.4. Here, stress is again proportional to the extent of deformation, which is now the extent of shear, gamma, and the constant of proportionality in between does again reflect the elasticity of the material. It is, however, now different in number from the Young's modulus that we have used in the former representation of Hooke's law, so we now give it a different letter. We name it G, the shear modulus. It's the constant of proportionality between the shear stress on the left-hand side of Hooke's law and the shear deformation or shear strain on the right-hand side of Hooke's law. In the simple model given in figure 4.2, the latter, by the way, is the ratio between the deflection and the constant height of the sample specimen. This also corresponds to the tangent of the shearing angle, as given to you in equation 4.5. Of course, elastic modulus and shear modulus of a material are related to each other. We can guess this intuitively already, as they are reflecting a very similar conceptual aspect. They reflect how difficult it is to deform the material, with different deformation geometries in each case. The relation between the two is established by taking into account the Poisson ratio that we have just introduced before, as shown in equation 4.6. The other extreme of mechanical behavior is viscous flow. We can idealize and conceptualize this to us by a dashpot model, as shown you in figure 4.3. In contrast to the elastic solid, here the stress that builds up in a material upon deformation is not proportional to the deformation itself, but to its time dependence, to its rate. In this case, there is no energy storage in the material. Instead, the energy of deformation that we put in during application of an external force or load is dissipated to heat, to the environment, which means that viscous deformation is irreversible. Again, we can establish a simple relation between stress and rate of strain in this case, which is named Newton's law, as given to you in equation 4.7 for the case of uniaxial deformation and in equation 4.8 for shear deformation. In both cases, the right-hand side does now not feature the deformation extent itself, not epsilon and gamma itself, but the respective time derivative of this, as indicated by the dot on top of the Greek letter in each case. The constant of proportionality in both cases is the viscosity eta. Both Hooke's law and Newton's law can be regarded from two viewpoint angles, respectively. First, both can be viewed from an engineering perspective. Both laws tell us how hard it is to deform a material. Hooke's law tells us what counteracting stress will build up in a material upon deforming it by a certain extent, and Newton's law tells us how much resistance a material does exert against the attempt of bringing it into motion. Both are certainly important for materials engineering. With both laws, we can quantitatively calculate how much a material will resist external forces, and is certainly of great relevance when construction pieces are to be designed. In addition to that, however, both these laws also have a microscopic interpretation. They both trace back to microscopic material properties. In the case of purely elastic deformation, of course, we can already imagine that the resistance that a material exerts against deformation must come from how strongly interactive its building blocks are and how they are arranged, most importantly, what distances they have to each other. This is exactly what we have regarded already in our two introductory lesson units on soft matter, when considering the cohesive energy density. This is nothing else than the energy of interaction between building blocks of material over the volume in which it's operative, which is simply the distance between building blocks cube, and that in turn can be simplified as the size of the building blocks cube. If we calculate that for normal hard matter, where we have interaction energies in the order of magnitude of chemical bonds, typically 10 to the minus 18 joules per bond, and where we have distances between the building blocks on the atomic or molecular scale, typically a tenth of a nanometer, then we end up at cohesive energy densities of around 10 to the 12 newton per square meters. This is exactly what we also typically measure for the elastic moduli of such materials. In contrast to that, in soft matter, we have to do with interaction energies a lot weaker, typically only 10 to the minus 20 joules per bond or per interaction. And those are operative over much larger distances, typically something in the range of some tens to hundreds of nanometers. If we calculate with those quantities, we end up at values of the cohesive energy density of only 10 to the 4 newtons per square meter, which is a typical elastic modulus of soft matter. The fundamental connection between the elastic modulus and the cohesive energy density, by the way, can also be rationalized when looking onto the units of the quantities. The cohesive energy density has the unit of energy over volume, joules over cube meters. And joules we can also express as newton times meter, so we have newton meter over cube meters, which gives us newton per square meters. And this is exactly also the unit of the elastic modulus. We can understand this when looking onto Hooke's law. In Hooke's law, we have stress, which is force over area on the left-hand side. So this has the unit newton per square meter. And on the right-hand side, we have strain, which is the relative extent of deformation, which is dimensionless. So this means the elastic modulus must also have the unit newton per square meters. This does also show how the elastic modulus is conceptually connected to the cohesive energy density. A similar discussion can also be led for Newton's law. In addition to being an engineering tool that tells us how much resistance a material exerts against the attempt to deform it by stirring or pumping, of course this also must have to do with its microscopic constitution. It basically traces back to the question of how easily can the building blocks of material move against each other? How easily can they switch their positions? And we've seen already that that has to do with an elementary microscopic material property, the relaxation time. And as maybe in your previous education you actually have already seen from a quite different viewpoint angle, times of microscopic processes have to do with activation energies for those. You may recall this from reaction kinetics. The rate constant of a chemical reaction is related to the energy of activation of the chemical reaction. And the rate constant in turn is related to characteristic timescales, for example, the half time. And so there is also a relation between those times and an energy of activation. The same is the case for the phenomenon of flow. On microscopic scales, this means building blocks have to move, they have to switch positions, they have to migrate over distances at least equal to their own sizes. This takes a certain time that we name relaxation time. And of course, this has to do with an energetic activation. Molecules have to migrate against each other. They have to overcome frictional forces. And that requires energetic activation. That establishes a relation between the engineering property viscosity to the microscopic constitution and dynamics of a material. And as we will also see later on in our class, all these quantities are of course also related to each other. Viscosity will turn out to be nothing else than the product between modulus and relaxation time. And this does also make somehow sense. Of course, viscosity will be higher if a material has a huge ability to initially store energy upon deformation and if it takes longer to relax that. But that we will discuss in much more detail and also quantitatively in a later lesson unit. When regarding soft matter, most materials that fall into this realm are not purely elastic solids or purely viscous liquids. There is something in between. They are viscoelastic. And strictly speaking, actually all matter exhibits this dualism. For example, if you imagine watching a glacier for one day, you will not be able to observe any perceivable movement. If, however, we visit the same glacier once a day, shoot a picture, and then put all these pictures together to a time lapse that spends, let's say, 10 years, we will see motion, flow of this glacier. Also, vice versa, if we consider a typical liquid, like a glass of water, we would never have the idea to call this elastic. This is a stereotype example of a viscous fluid. If, however, we watch this water on very, very short timescales, shorter than a nanosecond, then the building blocks of the material, in this case water molecules, will not have a chance to switch their positions, as we just don't give them enough time to do so. And that means on these super short timescales, the water that, for every one of us, is a stereotype example of a viscous liquid, is an elastic solid, to be precise, a glassy elastic solid. This means that the appearance of a material does always depend on the timescale that we consider. This principle is nicely reflected in the Greek aphorism Pantarei, everything flows. In rheology, we are interested in modeling and probing such properties of materials. How is this done? We basically have different means of how we can conduct rheological experiment. One simple type is the so-called relaxation experiment. In this kind of experiment, uniaxial strain or shear strain is applied to a sample, and then the resulting stress in the material is recorded as a function of time. This is shown to you in figure 4.4. Here, we apply a time-dependent box profile of strain to a material and regard the resulting time-dependent stress. In the case of a purely elastic solid, the time-dependent profile of the stress will be exactly matching the one of the condition of the strain, because both are proportional to each other with no time difference in between. A purely viscous sample, by contrast, will display two spikes in the stress, because here stress is the time derivative of strain, and the time derivative of the strain profile in the upper part of figure 4.4 is an infinitely steep ramp on both ends of the box profile. In the intermediate case of a viscoelastic sample, the initial response is similar to the elastic one. The stress increases proportionally to strain. Then, however, once the strain is kept constant, some of the initially stored energy of deformation is dissipated as heat, leading to stress relaxation over time. The reason for this ability of stress relaxation in a viscoelastic material is because the material is partially viscous. There is some ability for motion of the building blocks, for displacement, for rearrangement. And by that means, the system can escape the external load applied to it and adapt to it, thereby relieving or relaxing the stress in it. If the sample is a viscoelastic solid, the stress will reach a final plateau in the limit of infinite times with a value named plateau modulus. A counterpart to the relaxation experiment is the so-called creep test. Here we do the inverse. Here we apply stress and measure what the strain does. Again, let us consider the condition of a time-dependent box profile of the applied stress, as shown in the upper part of figure 4.5. The result, in the case of a purely elastic solid, is again a similar box profile, as again, stress and strain are just proportional to each other here, showing no time difference. The proportionality factor here, by the way, is named creep compliance. It's nothing else than the inverse of the elastic modulus, as here we do not have stress being proportional to strain with a constant of proportionality on the side of strain, but by contrast, strain being proportional to stress with a constant of proportionality being on the side of the equation with stress. And this is just the inverse of the elastic modulus. In contrast to that, an ideal viscous sample will exhibit a ramp profile, as shown in the lower right of figure 4.5. We can again understand this from Newton's law. Stress here is proportional to rate of strain, and this means strain is the integral of stress. If we apply a box profile, as shown in the upper part of figure 4.5, the integral of that is the profile obtained on the lower right of that figure. This is what we name creep curve. During application of strain, the material exhibits irreversible deformation. It creeps. In the intermediate case of a viscoelastic sample, again, the response is a mix of both. Once a constant amount of stress is applied, the recorded strain initially raises to some extent, and then with time, it raises further due to creep of the material, as the building blocks inside of it are to some extent irreversibly displaced against each other. If the sample is more elastic than viscous, it will reach a plateau for infinite times, whereas it would proceed creeping steadily if the material is more viscous than elastic. Once the test is finished, and the application of stress is released, the sample exhibits creep in the inverse, in the direction back. A third type of experiment that somehow combines the advantages of both a proceeding is a dynamic experiment. In such an experiment, the condition that we apply, either time-dependent stress or time-dependent strain, is a periodic oscillating function, like given by equation 4.10 for the application of time-dependent stress. What we then measure is the resulting, in this case, the resulting shear, which will also be time-dependent, also oscillating, but it may display a phase shift to the applied condition, as expressed by equation 4.11. Here, the phase shift is given by the variable delta. It can have values between 0 degrees and 90 degrees, or 0 and pi half, if you like that better. A graphical representation of this kind of experiment is given in figure 4.6. Again, we can quite easily quantitatively appraise how this should look like in the case of a purely elastic and in the case of a purely viscous material. Again, in the case of a purely elastic material, Hooke's law applies, in which stress and strain are proportional to each other, so here we would expect no phase shift between them, delta being zero. By contrast, in the case of a purely viscous material, Newton's law does apply. Here, stress is the derivative of strain. This means when we apply a sine wave function, we expect a cosine wave function for the result, and these two functions are shifted against each other by an angle of 90 degrees. This means here delta is 90 degrees, or pi half. Intermediate cases, viscoelastic cases, should then display a delta between these two extremes, delta between 0 and 90 degrees, or pi half. If we calculate the elastic modulus for such an experiment, we will realize that it turns out to be a complex quantity, as given to you in equation 4.12 for the case of shear deformation. This modulus will have two parts, a real part and an imaginary part, whereby the real part is given by equation 4.13 and the imaginary part is given by equation 4.14, both combining to the complex modulus according to equation 4.15. We can get an understanding of the physical meaning of these two parts by considering what they do for certain phase angles. For example, in the case of an ideal elastic solid, we will have a phase angle of zero. The sine of zero is zero. This means the imaginary part, g double prime, according to equation 4.14, will then also be zero, whereas by contrast, the real part, according to equation 4.13, will be the sole contributor to the modulus, with a value of sigma zero over gamma zero, times one, because the cosine of a delta value of zero is one. Vice versa, if the delta is pi half or 90 degrees, the real part of the modulus will be zero, and the imaginary part will fully contribute to it. This means that the real part has to do with the elastic properties of a sample, whereas the imaginary part captures its viscous properties. We therefore name the real part the storage modulus, whereas we name the imaginary part the loss modulus. Depending on the phase angle, more the one or more the other will contribute to the overall. A relation between these two is easily given by considering the ratio of the two parts, g double prime over g prime, in equation 4.16. If we plug in the formulas for both according to equation 4.13 and 4.14, we obtain that this ratio of g double prime over g prime is nothing else than the ratio of the sine and the cosine of delta, which is the tangent of it. This quantity, the tangent of the phase angle, also often named loss tangent, is a direct measure of the ratio of the viscous over the elastic properties of the material. The larger it is, the more does the material display viscous properties, whereas the smaller it is, the more does the material display elastic properties. We can do the very same calculation for the case of uniaxial deformation, by the way, as given to you in equations 4.17 and 4.18. To illustratively visualize to us the role of the two parts, the real and the imaginary part of the modulus, let us consider a rubbery ball that we drop from a certain height. We know it will bounce back from the floor and raise back to a certain elevation. Let's disregard friction with air here and consider what we would expect. If the material would be fully elastic, then we would expect this ball to bounce back to its original height, because all energy of deformation during the bounce will be gained back. By contrast, if the material would be completely viscous, we would expect it to splash to the ground. All energy would be lost and dissipated to heat during the splash. If the material is something in between, we can expect it to bounce back to a height that is given by the ratio of the two contributors to the modulus, the loss modulus and the storage modulus. This is shown to you in figure 4.7. This experiment is not only hypothetic, we can actually conduct it. We've considered it to be done with a rubbery ball. What is rubber? Rubber is a cross-linked polymer network. In such a material, the polymer strands between cross-linking points, so-called network chains, have the ability to store energy. Whereas parts of the sample that consists of loosely connected chains, chains that are connected to the network with one end, but then loosely dangle around because they have no secondary connection to a second point of the network, are able to dissipate energy. And it's now dependent on the microscopic structure of the polymer network to what extent the first type of structural feature and the second type of structural feature will contribute. A network with just little amounts of defects will have very good energy storage properties, and a rubber ball made out of this will bounce back to a considerable height. By contrast, a material with high fractions of such defects has good abilities for energy loss or dissipation, and it will not bounce back as high as the other one. This shows us how useful the complex number notation of the modulus is. It may appear a little frightening at a first glance, but as it turns out, it's very insightful, because the two parts of the complex modulus, the real and the imaginary one, have direct physical meaning by quantifying storage and loss properties of a material. We can guess already that also the other quantities that we have introduced today in our lesson unit, the inverse of the modulus, which is the creep compliance, and also its counterpart, viscosity, also turn out to be complex numbers for viscoelastic materials. This is given to you in equation 4.19 for the creep compliance and in equation 4.20 for the viscosity. In both cases, we simply calculate these quantities by taking their definitions. The creep compliance in equation 4.19 is defined as the inverse of the modulus, so it's not stress over strain, but strain over stress. Whereas the viscosity in equation 4.20 is given as stress over time derivative of strain. In both cases, we apply the respective exponential complex functions and calculate with them according to the rules of exponential function calculus, giving us the complex notations of both quantities in the respective lower right-hand side notations. We see that both quantities also consist of a real and an imaginary part, and we also see how these parts are respectively related to the real and imaginary part of the modulus. In the case of the creep compliance, real and imaginary parts of both belong together respectively, whereas in the case of viscosity, the relation is twisted. The real part of the viscosity has to do with the imaginary part of the modulus, and vice versa, also the imaginary part of the viscosity has to do with the real part of the modulus. And this makes perfect sense. The viscosity is a quantity that stands for energy dissipation. So of course, its real part will have to do with the respective other one from a quantity that by contrast stands for energy storage, and vice versa. To close this lesson unit, let us have a further view on the case of viscous flow. When considering flow, so far we have considered fluids that obey Newton's law, where stress and the rate of strain are proportional to each other with a constant of proportionality named viscosity. This viscosity we have taken as a constant, meaning not showing any own time or strain rate dependence. This is actually a simplification. Many soft matter materials are so-called non-Newtonian fluids, meaning their viscosity is further dependent on the experimental parameters, like, most importantly, the rate of strain. Let us regard figure 4.8a. It shows us a plot of stress versus rate of strain, a so-called flow curve. For the case of a Newtonian fluid, according to Newton's law, we would expect a straight line, the slope of which representing the viscosity. What we often see by contrast, however, is deviations from linearity in either the upper or the lower direction. We name these two deviation cases shear thickening and shear thinning. For example, polymer samples often exhibit shear thinning. That means a decrease of viscosity at increasing shear rate, as we see it for the lower curve in figure 4.8a, where the slope of the curve gets shallower with increasing shear rate. The reason for this is that when we apply stronger shear forces, we vary the sample. First, we destroy potential aggregate structures between the polymer chains, and second, we elongate them into the direction of flow. Both makes it easier for them to slip and slide against each other and to displace. Due to the circumstance that we change the sample structure upon application of shear, the phenomenon of shear thinning has been originally termed structural viscosity by Wolfgang Ostwald Jr. in 1825. The phenomenon of shear thinning is actually very beneficial in many applications. For example, when we think about wall paint or toothpaste or butter. These are all materials that you want to spread on a substrate. You want to spread the wall paint on the wall, you want to spread the toothpaste on your teeth, and you want to spread the butter on your bread. This means you want these materials to be easily deformable upon application of shear forces. But on the other hand, you also want them to stay in place when stopping to apply that load. You want the wall paint to stay in the wall once you stop brushing. All that is given if they are shear thinning, displaying low resistance against deformation as long as shear forces are applied, like during the brushing of the wall paint or during the spreading of the butter on your bread, whereas they display high viscosities and do no longer displace once we stop the application of those forces. The opposite case for that is shear thickening. In this case, the extent of viscosity, given by the slope of the curve in figure 4.8a, gets bigger with increasing shear rate. This is commonly observed for particle suspensions, whereas it's less common for polymer solutions or melts. Here, the microscopic explanation is that particle solutions can form transient hydrodynamic clusters of particles, which spontaneously form and break the whole time in the material. If we apply high shear rates, then the shear oscillation period gets shorter than the transient lifetimes of those clusters. And this means on the timescales of a shear amplitude, they are infinite in lifetime, resisting stronger against deformation than individual particles would do. A prime example is water sand suspensions, wet sand. You may know this from vacation at the beachside. When you carefully bury your feet into a wet beach, you can easily move them. But when you're trying to pull them out quickly, the wet sand is hard as concrete. This is exactly because it's shear thickening. We see from figure 4.8a that all the different cases converge with similar slopes, meaning with similar viscosities, in the limit of low shear. This is why often in experiments, we interpolate measuring curves to that extreme to determine the so-called zero shear viscosity. To complete our story, figure 4.8b adds two further common deviations from Newtonian flow. The so-called Bingham fluid and Casson fluid. These are materials that have a flow threshold, as shown by the non-zero intercept in that diagram. Such materials act as solids at zero or very low shear below the threshold, but flows like Newtonians or shear thinning fluids above the threshold. This mechanical behavior is often attributed to secondary interactions like van der Waals forces or hydrogen bonds in the material, which build up a sort of three-dimensional networks, house of cards structure, so to speak, that needs to be broken first before flow can set in. A prime example you may know from your everyday lives is ketchup. When you have a ketchup flask, initially nothing comes out, and if you shake it too heavily, everything splashes onto your plate. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. It has given us an introduction to the field of rheology. We have learned what rheology actually is, and we have got a first glimpse onto elementary cases of mechanical behavior of materials, in addition to very common types of experimentation. These target at determining characteristic material parameters, predominantly the elastic modulus in the case of an elastic solid, and the viscosity in the case of a viscous fluid. As it has turned out, we can also imagine intermediate cases for materials to display characteristics of both viscous liquids and elastic solids. This is very common for soft matter, and actually any material can do so, depending on the timescale whereupon which we consider it. An elegant way to treat this mathematically is to use a complex number notation, where the two parts of the respective quantities account for its elastic, storage, and its viscous loss properties. At a first view, this whole consideration appears to be very materials engineering related. We do not see so much the physics and chemistry yet, but we actually have got glimpses onto it already here and there in our discussion. We have seen that all these quantities, complex modulus, complex viscosity, in the end trace back to how the building blocks in the material are structured, how they interact, and how they are able or not able to move against each other. It is this bridge that we're targeting at in the further course of our discussion. To becoming able to do so, we must now take a next step and flank the experimental consideration with a theoretical consideration. And that will be the target of our next lesson unit.